Kushund, Memory Across Ages on the Wish-Bearing Tree. A Name in Indra's Assembly. Vasistha told Rama that the inquiry began in the court of Indra, ruler of the gods. Sages and celestial beings had gathered there, and their conversation turned to creatures whose lives extended across immense periods. Among those present was Shatatap, a learned ascetic known for restraint in speech and depth of experience. When the assembly considered the longest-lived beings, he named Bhushund. Shatatap placed him on the northeastern summit of Mount Meru, the cosmic mountain around which the story's geography is ordered. The peak shone with Padmaraga, a red jewel compared with ruby. On it grew a celebrated wish-bearing mango tree called Chuta. A hollow in the tree's right-hand trunk or branch held a beautiful nest. There, Shatatap said, lived Bhushund, king among crows, free from attraction and aversion, learned in the movement of time, and unmatched in longevity among beings of earth and heaven. Vasistha later asked Shatatap about the crow again. The account remained consistent. When Indra's assembly dispersed, the report continued to occupy him. He travelled by yogic power to Meru and reached the northeastern height that the sage had described. The mountain announced itself through red light. Its jewels, mineral colours, and golden surfaces cast a dusk-like radiance across the directions. Streams of the Ganga descended among its heights. Clouds sounded against the peaks, Gandharvas made music, and bees gathered over flowering groves. Gods rested on the rocks, celestial women moved among vine-covered bowers, and divine communities occupied caves and terraces across the mountain. The wish-bearing mango tree rose from that summit. Gold and silver-colored vines covered its boughs. Flowers, fruit, and leaves shone among branches broad enough to hold many communities. The tree resembled an elevated city of birds. Vasistha saw descendants of Brahma's swans, parrots associated with Agni, peacocks of Kartikeya's line, Bharadvaja birds, cranes, cuckoos, vultures, sparrows, and aerial species said to live without touching the earth. Bhushund's home was no lonely perch suspended beyond creation. The tree was rooted on Meru and crowded with life. Lineages connected with several deities occupied its branches, each in its own assembly. The crow who remembered cosmic time lived at the center of a functioning community and received Vasistha according to a recognized code of hospitality. Farther along the right side, a large assembly of crows sat around a spacious hollow. Bhushund occupied its center. His dark form was composed and graceful. Age appeared in him as settled intelligence, without infirmity or weariness. He had witnessed creation and destruction many times, yet his presence carried no agitation. Vasistha descended before the gathering. Bhushund recognized him at once through knowledge of past, present, and future. He rose, welcomed the sage, and by an act of intention manifested hands with which to offer flowers. He brought a fresh leaf from the tree as a seat, gave the customary water of welcome, and honored his guest. The surrounding crows grew quiet. Bhushund already knew about the discussion in Indra's assembly. He said that Vasistha's arrival had blessed the whole bird community and invited the sage to state his purpose aloud. Vasistha replied with 5 questions. From what lineage had Bhushund come? How had he attained knowledge? How old was he? Which events from earlier creations did he remember? Who had assigned him this dwelling on the tree? Bhushund did not separate the questions immediately. His birth, knowledge, residence, brothers, memory, and long life belonged to one sequence. To explain any part of it, he first had to describe the fierce divine family in which his father served. The order of the questions also sets the scale of what follows. Lineage and residence can be answered through a family history. Age requires an account of dissolution. Memory opens into recurring worlds. Longevity finally leads inward toward the habits of mind and the movement of breath. Vasistha has asked for facts about a remarkable creature, and Bhushund will answer by joining biography, cosmology, ethics, and contemplation. 21 Brothers. Bhushund began in the domain of Shiv. The ascetic deity bore the Ganga in his matted hair, the moon upon his head, serpents as ornaments, and sacred ash upon his body. Around him moved attendants of many shapes and the Matrikas, powerful divine mothers whose activity ranged across mountains, skies, other worlds, cremation grounds, and living bodies. 8 Matrikas held principal places: Jaya, Vijaya, Jayanti, Aparajita, Siddha, Rakta, Alambusa, and Utpala. Alambusa's vehicle was a powerful dark crow named Chand. He became Bhushund's father. During a fierce festival connected with Tumbru, a form of Rudra, and with Bhairav, the Matrikas drank, danced, sang, and released their formidable powers. The mythic episode includes violence against Uma. The mothers placed her under their power, used her body in their rite, and later reconstituted her when Shiv grew angry, returning her unharmed to him. The account belongs to the ritual mythology of these terrifying divinities. Its severity also establishes the setting in which the vehicles joined the celebration. The Matrikas combined protective and destructive force. Their festival carried intoxication, sexuality, and ritual violence, and its consequences extended to the animals who served them. Bhushund spoke of the episode because it established his genealogy, then returned to the 7 swans and Chand. 7 female swans who drew Brahmani's chariot became intoxicated during the festival. They united with Chand near the seashore and conceived. Afterward, they told Brahmani what had occurred. She released them from chariot duty while they carried their young and entered deep contemplation herself. The swans went to the root of the lotus, said to rise from Vishnu's navel, the lotus on which Brahma appears. There they laid 21 eggs. In due course, 21 crow brothers hatched and grew strong enough to fly. Bhushund was one of them. His family therefore comprised 7 swan mothers, Chand as father, and 20 brothers. The young crows returned with their mothers to Brahmani after she emerged from contemplation. They worshipped her, and through her grace received direct knowledge of reality and the condition described as liberation while living. Their insight came through maturity, reverence, and divine favor. It did not arise from the mere physical fact of their mixed parentage. Liberation while living means that insight is established while embodied activity continues. The brothers could still travel, ask for a dwelling, honor their parents, and inhabit a nest. Knowledge did not remove them from relationship or practical choice. Their next actions show awakened beings seeking conditions favorable to sustained contemplation. The brothers then flew to the Vindhya region, where Chand lived with Alambusa. Their father embraced them, and together they honored the Matrika. Chand asked whether they had escaped the net woven by worldly desire and its conditioning traces. If any bond remained, he was prepared to seek the goddess's help. The brothers answered that Brahmani's grace had given them the knowledge worth attaining. They now wanted a secluded home suited to contemplative life. Chand described Meru as extending 16,000 yojanas below the earth and rising 80,000 yojanas toward heaven. A yojana is a traditional measure of distance, so no modern conversion is needed here. Divine and semi-divine communities inhabited remote regions of the mountain, often too widely separated to see one another. On Meru's northeastern summit stood the wish-bearing mango tree. Chund had once made a nest there while Alambusa was absorbed in contemplation. He located it on the southern or right-hand branch and described its jeweled entrance, flower-lined interior, cool shelter, and inaccessibility even to many gods. He directed all 21 sons to live there. The brothers took leave of Chund and Alambusa. Before settling, they passed through the regions of wind and sun and through Amaravati, Indra's city, then visited Brahmani in Brahmaloka. She embraced them, heard their father's message, and gave her further blessing. They crossed the domains of the guardians of the directions, reached Meru, and entered Chund's old nest. That history answered three of Vasistha's questions. Chund and the seven swans established the lineage. Brahmani's grace explained the knowledge. Chund's former nest and instruction explained the residence. Bhushund presented every answer through relationship. Mothers, father, goddess, brothers, and inherited shelter all belonged to the life that followed. The route also matters. The brothers did not fly directly from birth to the tree. They approached the goddess who had granted understanding, visited their father and his divine mistress in Vindhya, received practical guidance, returned to Brahmani in her own realm, and crossed the celestial regions under her blessing. The nest became their home through permission, gratitude, and a sequence of leave-takings. Immense spans passed. The 20 brothers were learned, strong, and long-lived, yet each eventually relinquished his body. Bhushund said that they attained the state of Shiv. He alone remained as leader of the crow assembly. Their deaths kept his longevity from becoming a general promise attached to knowledge. All 21 shared the blessing of understanding, while divine ordering gave their embodied lives different courses. Bhushund regarded his crow body without vanity. Human society might consider such a form lowly, and time would consume even bodies admired for strength and sanctity. His contentment rested in the self. He used what came appropriately, avoided restless pursuit of what was absent, and attended to the consequences of ordinary conduct. Fear, possessiveness, and craving had lost their command over his mind. The jeweled light around the nest blurred the usual distinction between day and night. Bhushund still recognized the passage of time through the rhythm of vital movement within him. That quiet observation would eventually answer Vasistha's questions about his composure and long life. When the worlds dissolve, Vasistha asked how the tree survived the upheavals Bhushund had witnessed. The crow recalled times when Hiranyaksha carried the earth away, when mountains shook, when Mandara was torn from its place, when wars among gods and demons disturbed the sun and moon, when Kalanemi lifted Meru, and when the force of Garuda's wings shook the worlds. Through those convulsions, the wish tree remained secure in its divinely ordered position. Complete cosmic dissolution required another response. At the end of 1,000 Mahayugas, a full cycle in the traditional cosmology, Bhushund left the nest. Familiar geography and ordinary activity were ending. The decision to leave his home formed part of his steadiness. He released the mental constructions associated with place and rested in open awareness. When 12 suns rose and burned the worlds, he entered a contemplation identified with water and experienced himself as pervasive coolness. When winds capable of crushing mountains swept through creation, he adopted mountain-like stability. When the dissolving worlds became one expanse of water, he abided in the principle of air above it. Through these contemplative identities, Bhushund met each stage of dissolution without clinging to the form it destroyed. He then passed beyond the cosmic enclosure and rested in an undifferentiated absorption while created forms remained withdrawn. When Brahma began another creation, Bhushund entered the new cosmos. A Meru appeared in a corresponding configuration, and a wish-bearing tree occupied the familiar place. Recognition connected the new arrangement with the former one, and he returned to the corresponding nest. Vasistha asked why other accomplished yogis did not preserve their bodies and return in this way. Bhushund invoked Niyati, the divine ordering power through which each being's course unfolds. One person's embodied continuity, another's relinquishment of the body, and a third person's liberation follow different conditions. The result could not be obtained by copying an external routine. Niyati here names the ordering through which capacities, past tendencies, environments, and outcomes take their particular course. Bhushund did not claim personal superiority over the yogis who disappeared at dissolution. His brothers had already shown that relinquishing a body could coincide with complete knowledge. His own return gave him the continuity to remember changes that other lives could not report. The same principle qualified Bhushund's language about the tree. He called it the same wish tree because its place, form, and relation corresponded with what memory knew. The constituent world had been dissolved and created again. Directions, mountains, companions, and dwellings also reappeared in recognizable arrangements while their material formations changed. His continuity lay in recognition across cycles and in the consciousness within which both memory and fresh perception arose. This distinction allowed him to endure change without demanding that each world repeat every detail. It also prepared Vasistha for the largest part of the answer, the events preserved in a memory spanning many creations. The worlds Bhushund remembers. Bhushund did not offer a single continuous chronology. He opened a catalogue of worlds, each with its own arrangement. The statements belong to his remembered cosmology, and their numbers remain his reported measures of cyclic time. For a Western reader accustomed to history organized along one line, the catalogue requires a change of scale. These are memories of successive creations, not dates placed on one earth. Familiar names can recur, while the bearer of a name, the surrounding geography, and the order of events differ. The account uses recurrence to examine how recognition works when neither absolute sameness nor complete novelty explains what memory finds. He remembered an earth without rock, grass, vines, trees, mountains, or forests. During another period, the ground beneath Meru lay under a vast covering of ash for 11,000 years. He knew a creation in which the sun and moon had yet to appear. Light from Meru's jewels illuminated part of the world, while other regions remained dark. In one age, demons ruled a prosperous earth. In another, the ocean covered every region except Meru, where Brahma, Vishnu, and Shiv remained. One earth held only forest for 2 yugas, without towns or other developed communities. Another bore mountains alone for over 4 yugas, with no human inhabitants moving among them. For 10,000 years, a different earth was covered by mountains formed from the bones of dead demons. He remembered periods when fear drove sky-traveling gods from sight and when darkness covered a treeless earth. He recalled Vindhya rising to rival Meru and Agastya traveling south. In one creation, earth and mountain had no established names, while gods and siddhas lived in space under a light independent of sun and moon. Another world had no Indra, king, or social hierarchy, while its directions remained dark. There had been an earth full of trees before any ocean was conceived. Mind-born persons such as Bhrigu appeared there without sexual generation. Bhushund had also witnessed disorder within a Satyayug, the age conventionally associated with truth, and conduct resembling that age within Kali Yuga, traditionally associated with decline. The label assigned to an age did not guarantee the behavior of those living in it. Turning to Vasistha himself, Bhushund said that the sage's present embodiment was the eighth in which they had met. Across creations, Vasistha had appeared from space, water, wind, mountain, and fire. Bhushund remembered three creations closely matching the present arrangement, and 10 in which the conduct, bodies, ages, and offices of the gods followed the same pattern. Other events returned with altered details and counts. In 5 creations, Kurma, the tortoise form, raised the earth from the ocean in the place normally associated with Varaha. The present churning of the ocean for nectar was the 12th that Bhushund remembered. Hiranyaksha had carried the herb and sap-bearing earth to the nether region 3 times. Parashurama's current destruction of warrior rulers was the 6th such campaign. Bhushund counted 100 Buddhas appearing as a son of Suddhodana across 100 Kali Yugas. He remembered Shiv destroying Tripura 30 times, as well as recurring destructions of Daksha's sacrifice, repeated punishments of Indras, and 8 battles between Hari and Hara. Vedic recitation, subsidiary disciplines, and rites changed in response to the capacities of the students in each age. Puranas carried related meanings through different authors and forms. Histories were composed, forgotten, and composed again. He remembered another knowledge text called Ramayana, containing 100,000 verses. The Maharamayana, that would preserve Vasistha's instruction to Rama, would be composed by Valmiki in 32,000 verses, the 12th composition in Bhushund's recurring sequence. A corresponding Mahabharata would be composed for the 7th time. Within the same reported sequence, Vishnu's coming birth as Rama would be the 11th under that name. Narsingh had slain Hiranyakashipu 3 times. Krishna's future birth in the house of Vasudev, undertaken to relieve the burden of the earth, would be the 16th. These figures express the scale and recurrence of Bhushund's testimony inside the text. They do not function as dates in modern textual history. Relations changed along with worlds. A son might occupy a father's role, a friend might appear as an enemy, and social gender roles could reverse. Bhushund's companions, attendants, homes, and mountains differed from one Manvantara to another. At times he lived in Vindhya or elsewhere before returning, under the force of established tendencies, to the nest on Meru. A Manvantara is a traditional era governed by a Manu, a progenitor and lawgiver for its cycle. Bhushund uses these vast divisions as naturally as another narrator might distinguish one reign from the next. His memory does not flatten them. Each era brings a new practical world, new relations, and a fresh distribution of authority, even when an older name or pattern becomes recognizable. Directions themselves depended on the arrangement of the poles, stars, sun, and moon. When those relations changed, north and east acquired new orientation. Memory recognized similarity without freezing the cosmos into one material structure. Bhushund therefore described the world as an appearance within consciousness. Calling it a permanent, independent substance failed to account for the reversals he had witnessed. Treating it as mere blankness also failed to account for lived experience. Its forms rose and subsided like waves within a common field of awareness. Names returned, patterns repeated, and relationships shifted, while consciousness remained the ground in which all of them became known. This conclusion gives philosophical purpose to the numerical abundance. Bhushund is not collecting marvels for their own sake. Every altered world tests the boundary between an object and the act of recognizing it. The present Meru resembles an earlier Meru. A Vasistha appears for an 8th meeting. A scripture returns with another length or composition number. Consciousness permits the relation to be known while leaving each manifested form subject to change.
The mind death cannot govern.
Vasistha brought the inquiry from cosmic time to Bhushun's living body. What conditions, he asked, had kept death from consuming him? Bhushund began with the states that wear down a life from within, craving ties, attraction, and aversion into the heart. Anxiety cuts repeatedly through the mind. Unchecked hope produces heat. Greed waits for an opening. Anger dries up discernment, and lust subjects the person to relentless pressure. These habits continually disturb the mind and intensify the fear attached to bodily change. Bhushund described clear awareness as a heart whose knots had loosened. A person could still give, receive, speak, work, earn, and fulfill responsibilities while inner completion ceased to depend upon each result. Physical difficulty and mental pain could still be registered without organizing the whole field of identity. The mind ceased rushing after one condition and recoiling from the next, leaving discernment available for appropriate action instead of continual defense of possession, reputation, or expectation. He had seen gods, celestial musicians, and heavenly companions. He had observed the kingdoms, mountains, cities, and seas of earth, as well as the serpent and demon worlds below. Pleasure in every realm began under conditions and ended when those conditions changed. None could supply permanent security to a mind seeking its own completion from an object. Bhushund's language about freedom from death has to be read beside the rest of his account. His 20 enlightened brothers relinquished their bodies and reached the state of Shiv. His own exceptional duration belonged to a distinct ordering of conditions. He offered no mechanical promise that mental calm or breath awareness would make everybody immortal. The teaching addresses death at several levels. Bodily life has limits. Fear can make each change feel like a threat to the whole self. Desire and anxiety can consume the present before the body ends. Knowledge loosens the identification through which every alteration of the body seems to alter consciousness itself. For Bhushund, this freedom allowed a remarkable embodied continuity. For his brothers, knowledge remained complete even as their bodies ended. This layered meaning keeps the narrative from collapsing into a longevity manual. Vasistha's interest begins with the age of a creature and reaches the quality of awareness through which that age is lived. A thousand cycles filled with craving would extend disturbance. Bhushund's long duration carries philosophical force because his mind remains generous, attentive, and free from the pressure to turn experience into possession. Vasistha then asked about the contemplation Bhushund practiced through waking, dreaming, and deep sleep. The answer entered the traditional subtle physiology of prana and apana. The city of breath. Bhushund compared the body to a house. Bones served as supports, sinews as bindings, flesh as wall material, and the sensory openings as gates. Within this old architectural image, vital movement animated a network that ordinary sight could not observe. The account names Ida and Pingala as two subtle channels on the body's sides. It describes three paired heart lotus structures connected with 72,000 channels and 101 principal branches. The lotuses open and contract under the movement of vital air. Different functions of that movement receive the names prana, apana, samana, udana, and vyana. Seeing, touch, speech, digestion, circulation, and other bodily activities are assigned within this traditional model to the operation of life force. The five names distinguish functions within a single vital principle. Prana commonly names the upward or life-sustaining movement. Apana, the downward movement. Samana, the equalizing function associated with digestion. Udana, the rising function associated with speech and upward motion. And Vyana, the distributing movement through the body. The story quickly returns to prana and apana because their alternating course gives Bhushund the clearest field for sustained observation. Bhushund centered his contemplation on two movements. Prana is the ascending and outward moving force compared with the sun and with heat. Apana is the descending and inward returning force compared with the moon and with coolness. They were the two wheels of the mind's vehicle and the two horses moving the body house. Their alternation continued while a person walked, stood, worked, ate, woke, dreamed, and slept. Bushund described their field as extending 12 finger widths beyond the nose or body, and elsewhere as 12 or 16 fingers. A finger width is the traditional bodily unit in this account. He called the 12-finger boundary Dvadashanta and treated it as part of contemplative experience. Within this model, the natural outward movement from the heart is called exhalation, or rechaka. The returning movement is inhalation, or puraka. Kumbhaka names the suspension or quiet interval associated with a movement's completion. An outer junction appears when the outgoing prana has subsided and the returning apana has yet to arise. An inner junction appears when apana has completed its movement and prana is beginning again. Bushund followed the same cycle from the heart, the nose, and the 12-finger boundary. Outward movement, its completion, inward movement, and the corresponding inner completion. He attended to where each current began, where it ended, and how awareness remained present as one gave way to the other. Bushund directed attention to the instant of transition. A movement ends. Before its counterpart becomes active, there is a subtle interval. The point of his account lies in recognizing the awareness present through departure, return, and quiet. Breath offers an immediate field in which movement and its cessation can both be observed. He compared consciousness within prana to fragrance within a flower, and consciousness within apana to sweetness within water. Awareness reveals the beginning of a movement, its course and its end. It also reveals the pause in which no gross movement occupies attention. Mind, intellect, ego, senses, and body perform their functions within that field of knowing. Prana and apana are also described as sun and moon within the heart space. Heat moves outward, coolness returns inward. Their rising and setting provide a small cycle that accompanies every activity. The imagery gives contemplative form to a basic question: what knows the movement and what knows its stillness? Bushund's attention rested in that continuity of knowing. Bushund associated exhalation, inhalation, and suspension with purification of mind and freedom. His practice was sustained attention to the breath's natural movement and quiet junctions. It was not a timed drill, forced retention, treatment, or guarantee of physical longevity. Bushund emphasized the natural and continuous character of the movements. His contemplation remained active during ordinary conduct and all three commonly named states of waking, dream, and deep sleep. He did not confine it to a session separated from the day. Repeated attention gradually made the rhythm a steady reminder of the consciousness in which the body acted. This continuity explains why breath is a doorway in the story instead of its final object. Counting a movement could sharpen attention, yet the teaching proceeds toward the ground of experience. The body changes, prana moves, apana returns, and moments of quiet occur. Awareness makes each condition known without assuming the shape of any one condition. Bushund described this steadiness as samadhi, contemplative absorption or complete equanimity. It remained while he was walking or standing, awake or asleep, active or still. Such continuity changed the meaning of practice. A secluded exercise could establish attention. Daily conduct revealed whether that attention survived contact with appetite, fatigue, gain, injury, responsibility, and other people. The passage also clarifies the relation between contemplative practice and Bhushan's ethical life. Attention can remain technically narrow while anger, greed, possessiveness, and hostility govern conduct. Bhushan described a steadiness that entered relationships, choices, duties, pleasure, loss, and speech. His account of the breath belongs inside that larger discipline of mind. A mind that does not leave the present. Bhushan said that he did not live by repeatedly entering the past or projecting himself into future gain. His vast memory remained available, yet it did not draw him away from the duty immediately before him. He performed the work of the present without fastening his peace to its reward. Desired and undesired events arrived. Prosperity and hardship altered the body's circumstances. Heat and ice retained different practical effects. A piece of wood and a mountain remained distinct objects. Through those useful differences, Bhushan recognized a common basis in consciousness. The recognition weakened possessive division and reduced the fuel available to fear and hostility. He did not divide beings rigidly into his own people and outsiders, friends and enemies. The body breathed, ate, walked, slept, and woke, while he declined to treat its activity as the whole self. Care for the body continued. Identity gained a wider foundation than the body's present condition. His conduct carried the same understanding. He refrained from harming others even when he possessed strength. Injury from another did not compel him to surrender judgment to anger. He practiced contentment when resources were limited and regarded the conscious presence in other beings with the respect he gave his own life. When others were happy, he shared their happiness. When they suffered, compassion arose. Praise and blame did not determine his inward state. Wealth could increase or vanish without producing intoxication or collapse. He laid aside the claim that his individual ego alone authored every action. Old things appeared fresh because memory no longer covered the present with fatigue. Knowledge deepened courtesy and attention instead of making him indifferent to the world around him. These qualities formed one discipline. Present-centered action, reduced possessiveness, freedom from the fever of results, compassion, non-injury, equanimity, awareness of prana and apana, and repose in consciousness. Niyati had given Bhushan an extraordinary duration. His discipline gave that duration clarity. When the answer ended, Vasistha praised the crow's life and understanding. He had travelled widely and met gods, sages, and accomplished practitioners, yet Bhushan's settled intelligence remained rare. The time for Vasistha's midday duties in the realm of the seven sages had arrived, and he asked leave to depart. Bhushan rose and worshipped his guest once again. With hands produced by resolve, he held a vessel made from a golden leaf, filled it with water bright as pearls and pollen from the wish tree's flowers, and offered the rites of farewell. Vasistha urged him to remain at the nest. The crow followed him through the sky as courtesy required. They travelled together for one yojana. Vasistha then took Bhushan's hand and gently stopped him. The two friends parted and passed beyond each other's sight. Bhushan returned to the nest. Vasistha reached the realm of the seven sages, where Arundhati welcomed him and he met the other seers. Vasistha fixed the chronology for Rama. His first meeting with Bhushan occurred after the first 2 centuries of Satyayuga. By the time of the present instruction, that age had ended and Tretayuga had begun. Vasistha had visited the same summit again 8 years before telling the story. Bhushan's appearance remained free from signs of age. The later meeting confirmed what Vasistha had seen. No further debate was needed. He ended by asking Rama to consider Bhushan's account and apply its insight according to sound judgment. A life becomes clear when awareness remains present through movement, stillness, memory, and change.